everyone. I'm now on Patreon. Click the link below. Not only keep the free content coming with tutorials, tips, podcasts, etc., but get a bunch of free stuff like live stream Q&As, copy of my book, voting on topics, behind the scenes, bunch of cool stuff. Click the link down below to join. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to episode 10 of the Scott Stokely podcast. And I am talking to someone that if you look on your screen, you probably don't realize is a big, big name in the sport of disc golf. You've heard of him, but might not know that you've heard of him. There is a book out there that I believe is the number one selling book in the history of disc golf called The Zen of Disc Golf. And I'm being joined by the author, Patrick McCormick. Patrick, thanks for coming on.
Oh, Scott, thanks. It's an honor. I'm glad to be here.
No, I really appreciate that. And we connected through some things, you could almost say non-disc golf related, sure. Even though they are, but they're kind of not, which I want to get to in a minute.
Yeah.
But just real quick, I always want to start a little bit of a background. Let's talk about the Zen of Disc Golf and how you got, well, about you in the sport and the book. And then once we kind of lay the foundation, we're going to dig deep on some things.
All right, great. Sounds good. All right. So basically, I've been playing disc golf for about 23 years. I started when I was probably 13 or 14 years old back in the mid 90s. And I started playing with a church youth group. And that was, I guess, high school, early high school, something like that. And when I went off to college, I did take a hiatus for an extended period of time. So I wasn't playing consecutively through all that time. I did a lot of other things creatively and made a living that way, in addition to college. But once I got married, I realized that I was living almost next door to the disc golf course that I played on in my youth. And I had retired from some of the other things that I was doing creatively, and I needed something to pass the time. And so I went out and I started playing disc golf one day, and then I played the next day, and then I played the next day. And then that went on for probably a couple years. And I've always been a creative person. And so I needed a creative outlet, and I've always written stuff, whether it was poetry. Earlier on in college, I did write an unpublished novel. So there's a lot of writing that goes on in my history, not just books, but music as well. I was out on the disc golf course, and being a fan of Persig's novel or book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, I thought, how cool would it be if somebody were to write a book called Zen and the Art of Disc Golf? Because I was experiencing a lot on the disc golf course where I was learning a lot about myself, for good, for better or for worse. And, you know, started experiencing in real time this a philosophy that sometimes goes along with golf, and you know, it naturally moves into disc golf and things like that. And so I started writing, and initially it was just writings in a notebook or, you know, on a computer about some of the things that I was thinking about while I was on the course. And as a side note, when I was off the course, I was talking to a lot of people and, you know, trying to explain my life philosophies to them and things that I was learning about myself and, you know, power of positive thinking and things like that. And I kept saying, well, it's kind of like when you're on the tee pad on hole number 8, you know, and these people don't play disc golf. So they're just like, why is he talking about this froth thing again? And so I had written all these things, and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be great if I could put this kind of ideas and metaphors into people's hands that, you know, absolutely love the sport? Because, you know, as I've always said, once you hear those chains, it's an addiction, you know, you're stuck on it. And so I wrote, it was partially sort of a memoir and partially sort of motivational, and kind of merged them together. And then the original idea, this went on for about 3 years. And the original idea was to put it on the internet just as a Kindle copy. I didn't really recognize that it had any potential for selling. While I was thinking about doing that, my wife was saying, well, why don't you look into making a paperback as well? And I was just, all right, whatever. You know, I started looking into the possibility of self-publishing. And meanwhile, while that's going on, I'm building up the social media, and Instagram was big. and, you know, Facebook ended up being big. I was never huge, and I couldn't do the Twitter thing because I just couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure out what I needed to say at the time. So still, right. You won't find me very much on Twitter, but I'm heavy on Instagram and heavy on Facebook. So anyway, I started building those up and figuring out ways to build it up. And as I was doing it, just building a fan base. And then the night of its release, it was in November of 2014. I dropped it for pre-sale. And I just saw the numbers just going, do. I said, holy cow, look at this, honey. And she said, you know, how many of these copies do you think that you're going to sell? And I was like, well, you know, I'd be happy if I sold 5 or 10. But it was right before Christmas and sales were phenomenal. And I got invited to do some book signings at our local pro shops here, which are Play It Again Sports. I got invited to do some of that. And then I ended up meeting a lot of people who really liked the book. And, you know, the whole process was really like out of the blue for me, because like I said, I didn't know I wrote this for me. I didn't know it was going to sell as well as it did. And that was almost 7 years ago, and it's still selling really well. And people ask me all the time, how many have you sold? And until recently, because I decided to write a new book, I didn't have an answer for that because there was no real method to track exactly how many paperbacks and how many Kindles and how many Audible copies and all of those things, plus how many bulk orders that I sold to pro shops around the world, signed copies that have sold off my website, things like that. But I ended up coming up with sort of a rough estimate of 10,000 copies. And I didn't even know that until like last month. So very blessed. And, you know, the biggest blessing of all this throughout all this has been my fan base, because even when I disappeared for a short amount of time, I still have fans that I have become really good friends with, who stayed with me throughout some harder periods in my life within the past few years. And man, and then I jump back into it and say, hey, I'm back, and everybody, oh, thank God you're back, you know. And it's so, what an exciting thing I've created, and I didn't even know what I was doing. I'm still winging it day by day.
Right. That I think that's amazing. And you had print copies, which is, so I wrote the first book on disc golf throwing technique.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That I released in 2000. And I was left with a choice then, because we were going to have to self-publish and then we were going to wholesale. And I was looking at it and I remember thinking, I'll make like a couple dollars a book.
Right.
If I, you know, have to do all the printing myself. But I also could release it as an ebook for $19.95, sell it direct, and I would make $19.95 a book.
Yep.
And I also figured out I could sell a printed copy where the person would print it for $5 and I could sell it for $25. And I thought, man, if this book is going to look really ugly, but I'm going to make $20 instead of two. So it was a completely financial decision. But then in hindsight, I never had a pretty book to put on my shelf with my name on the spine. Right. That I always thought would have been really neat.
Well, you know, what's really great about living in the day and age that we live in. And I want to say this was kind of a newer industry, at least in maybe 2014. It's not so new anymore because it's been around a while, but on-demand publishing and on-demand printing is the way to go for, you know, people releasing their own media. And I started learning about this because I was in the music industry. And so, you know, it's really hard for musicians to get a record deal. And then at the end of the day, they're only making like 14% of the record sales. And this was back when, you know, you actually bought and sold records.
Right.
So it's just very minimal amount of money. But so I got involved in doing on-demand publishing of music years ago. And so I thought, well, maybe there's a way that we can do this book so I don't have to have this huge inventory of books in my house. And so on-demand was the way to go, because like you said, they just take a relatively low percentage. They handle all of the delivery. They handle all the inventory. I don't have to have a huge inventory. I do keep some because I do sell signed copies from time to time. And sometimes I do giveaways and things like that, but I don't have to have a massive warehouse, you know? And interestingly enough, I was approached back in, I think it must have been 2016, by a sports publisher. And I don't remember which one it was, but they, you know, that they specialize in sports books, and they approached me with a deal for my book. And I took a look at it and I'm like, no, I'm not going to give you my copyright and my publishing rights for the amount of money that they said, well, we can get you in every store. I said, well, I'm already in every store. So how do you beat that? And what I mean by that is I'm not already, like, and if you go into a Barnes and Noble, you probably won't find Zen and the Art of Disc Golf. But if you walk up to the counter and you say, I want to order a copy of Zen and the Art of Disc Golf, they're going to order one for you. And they won't just order one for the shelf. They'll order, you know, five, because now they've seen a demand in that area for that book. So they'll sell one and then they'll put the other four on the shelf. And so it just really works out. And I love on demand for everything. I do on demand, for the apparel that I'm selling. I don't have to keep a big warehouse. I know that it's quality goods, you know, and that's been a real blessing. So push comes to shove, I wrote that company back who wanted to do it. I said, well, can you match X amount, which is what I make per book? And they said, not even close. I said, thank you. Have a nice day. Right.
Yeah, I've had certain meetings regarding my book where I just kind of laughed at it. I was like, no, this is, like, this sounds like the, the golden something that you're...
Golden egg, yeah, like you're getting a record deal.
Mm-mm. Yeah, and it's like, no, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
All right, so you took a break for a while, and this is what I really wanted to, what I'm really interested in talking to you about.
Sure.
As our lives crossed in a very specific way, only kind of related to disc golf. And right. that's what led you to reaching back out to me, or reaching out to me. Can you tell that story? You know what I'm referring to.
Right. And there's a lot of layers to this. I know where you want to go with this, and I'm going to take you there. But generally I've been following you, or I've been a fan of yours since I got back into the sport, 2011, 2012-ish. And I was watching your videos, you know, trying to learn sidearms and all that kind of stuff. I was watching you, man. My sidearm isn't so good because I jacked my hand up now, and I'm still trying to figure out how to get my grip going again. but we'll work on it. Anyway, so I was thinking about writing a new book, which I did complete this year, and I'm pretty excited about that. But I looked up to see if there were any other people who had new disc golf books on Amazon. And it just so happened I found yours, and I thought, oh, cool, Scott has a book out. And so I went to your website and I started reading more about you, some background stuff that I didn't know. And one of the things that hit me was that you work with special needs people and children. And so I already knew we had disc golf in common, but the special needs, you had a little link down at the bottom, autism awareness. So I clicked that and I watched your video where you were talking about what it's like for autism parents. And to be honest with you, I just started bawling, and my wife was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, it's like Scott knows our life. And of course, by now in this conversation, you figured out that we have a special needs child. We have a child with autism. His name is Bryce, and he's 5 years old. He's nonverbal. He's a type 2 autistic child. And as much blessing as he's brought to our life, it has become significantly more difficult than early on in 2014 and, you know, well, 2015 and 2016 is when I was running the Zen Disc Golf podcast. And, you know, that's when he was young, he was a baby. And in the beginning, it was just baby stuff, you know, learning how to be a dad, you know, learning how to be parents and all of that. But then as he got older, his ability to communicate socially just didn't change. And so he became 3 years old and 4 years old, and we were experiencing meltdowns. and we're experiencing all of these things. And I had no level of awareness of autism other than the fact that it existed. You know, I didn't really know so much about it. And, you know, I'd seen a lot of things, you know, autism awareness. And I used to think, oh, I'm aware there is autism. Well, I'm really aware about autism now. But like I said, so when I saw that, I said, all right, I got a new book coming out. I'm trying to start my podcast back up. I'm looking for guests. And then I thought, Scott is the guy, because we are tied together in several different worlds. And what an exciting thing to be on your show and to do, and that you're going to do my show. And we get to talk about disc golf, and we get to talk about trials of our lives and, you know, special needs and autism awareness. It's great stuff.
Yeah. So, and I was really, really touched when you said that you felt like I actually got it and that I understand. But I also disagreed with you.
Right.
Because to me, it's like, I'm a blind person who, when you say what happens when you mix blue and yellow, I can say you get green. Therefore, I understand colors. In fact, I got a wealth of database. I got the whole RGB code memorized. I can communicate what the color wheel looks like and its purpose. Like I
can... Are you saying all this because you know I'm colorblind?
No, but my knowledge is like I can recite all this information just like a blind person can tell you all about color, but they've never seen it.
Right.
And so I was touched and flattered that you said that, but it doesn't, I would never say that I understand. I think what I've been able to do is I've been around it enough to maybe bridge the gap and help communicate what's happening to people who haven't been there. And I think I can do it pretty effectively, but it doesn't mean I understand.
Well, but here's what's unique about that, Scott. We have people who are very close to us who could not communicate in the way that you do, the way that you did in your video. It's almost in our lives that we have to convince people that we live a different life than other people, because autism parents are so often approached with the, well, my kid's just like that too. Or, yeah, that's all how all toddlers are. And you know, that's not true, you know, and to a certain extent, people want to, they don't like feeling uncomfortable when you say, I have a different life and it's not easy. And they want to try to make you feel better about it. And that's to their credit, but it really diminishes what special needs parents, go through. And there's many other things in life that are very similar to this. People don't like conflict, and they don't like uncomfortable thoughts or feelings. And so what they often try to do instead of show empathy is to try to diminish the subject matter. And while they mean well, it can be very hurtful. So people who are very close to us in our lives aren't able to articulate like you did just in one video. And I'm like, I'm just looking for somebody to talk about disc golf, but holy cow, this guy has at least a little bit or can communicate what me and my wife have gone through for the past 3 years. And I said, I'm reaching out to this guy. And I think my email to you was very demanding. We are going to do this show. We've got to, because I think we just, you know, I think we can understand and communicate well to each other.
Yeah. And I think you're right. People, they don't understand, but maybe they don't acknowledge they don't understand. They don't know what they don't know.
True.
And it's funny, as you mentioned that, one of the things I experienced was parents, and your kid is lucky. You have a two-parent household. Autism is a single-parent world. It's like 82% single parent. Most often single moms, even though a lot of the dads are still in the picture, the strain on the relationship leads to single parents mostly single mom. That's just statistical reality.
Yes.
And one of the things I observed is that the minute the mom starts to even communicate, I say mom, that's not fair. That's totally unfair. The minute the parent says, this is hard, that gets interpreted as feel sorry for me, pay attention to me. I want you to, this is about me.
Yes.
It's not. It is saying that this is fucking difficult and I need something. But even communicating that, it almost seems like you're playing the victim role when really you're just saying, no, my reality is different. Has that been your experience that just even communicating your experience can be misinterpreted, or do you worry about that?
Oh, absolutely. And let me be the first to say, we don't view our child as being disabled. He is very able, and we are very blessed that he doesn't have, you know, an illness that keeps him bedridden or something of that nature. I'm also a firefighter and a medic, and so I come into contact with a lot of that as well. Bryce is very blessed. People within the autism community, parents, they more often than not just need to know that someone's hearing them, just need to know that someone understands that their life is different and they may need extra help. And you're so right. It's like 82 to 90% of marriages end in divorce. And it's because it takes so much energy and patience when you have an autistic child, that a lot of times that patience is not reserved for the spouse any longer. And so I couldn't imagine my wife doing this without me, as much as I couldn't imagine doing it without her, because it really takes more than her and I, and we struggle with the two of us. So when we reach out and when we post things, and my wife often does on Facebook, she likes to post things to drive a certain amount of awareness about both Bryce and autism, but also about how what it's like to be an autism parent or a special needs parent. And a lot of times it's just, please help us. We just need some help. It's not, we don't need money. We just need somebody to come over and let us go on a date, or we need, you know, some kids for Bryce to play with, especially hard in this COVID period. I mean, he's spending a lot of time alone, which is probably the worst thing that, you know, for Bryce, for any kid, for any human being. We are a social creature and we should be spending time with other people. But now is the time where Bryce is trying to develop social awareness and social skills, and this COVID thing is sort of depriving him of that. But, you know, we reach out and she reaches out on the internet because we're just saying, hey, come help us. Come, you know, just share a sense of empathy with us. And empathy today is much lacking in our society as opposed to sympathy. Empathy. Are you familiar with Brené Brown at all?
I'm not.
Okay. So she is a very famous psychological, she's really a shame researcher is what she calls herself, but she deals a whole lot with the subject of vulnerability and empathy. And she has a really good video. If you look it up on YouTube, it's called, just look up Brené Brown, B-R-E-N-E Brown, and empathy. And there's a little cartoon that goes along with it. And she says that sympathy is like when you have a friend in a hole and the friend leaves. Well, let me start with empathy. We'll talk about empathy.
Okay.
You have a friend that has fallen into a hole. And so what you do for that friend when you're an empathetic person is you lower a ladder down in that hole and you climb down in that hole and you sit next to that friend and you say, I don't know what you're going through, but I'm here with you. Okay. So that's empathy. Sympathy is when you stand on the edge of the hole and say, oh, it looks dark down there. Sure does look scary. You want a sandwich? You know, so you're there, but you're not down in the hole with the person. as a society, whether it's special needs parenting or whether it's somebody who's gone through some hard times, depression, PTSD, some of these things I've experienced for myself, addiction, things of that nature. We need to be a more empathetic society if we ever want to show the world that we have a capacity for love. And unfortunately, in the day and age of social media, where we're so disconnected, and it's funny, I saw a news story the other day. It just happened to be on the news, and they said something about kids are feeling more and more isolated online due to COVID. Not isolated as human beings, but we've gotten to the point where they're feeling isolated online. So we've become so isolated as a culture, as a result of this tool, which is a fantastic tool. Look at us. We're talking, are you still in Tennessee or?
No, I'm in Georgia.
You're in Georgia. Okay. I'm in Virginia. You're in Georgia. And we're talking and we're recording this long form conversation. And we will continue to do this on your podcast and on my podcast, an important conversation. And who knew that it was going to go to the empathy zone? But empathy is like a practice that we need to, in order to show love to people, sometimes we got to crawl down in the hole with them. And then on the other side, sometimes we have to admit to ourselves and to others that we are in a hole. And it's just a struggle in today's society because that doesn't get likes. You know what I mean? So.
And you're right. I mean, with the special needs parents I've met, it isn't sympathy because they're strong, incredibly strong people. You have to be, or else you will just crumble. And so it is, you're right. It's not sympathy. So I want to ask you this. What's your wife's name?
Her name is Chris.
And you guys are doing well as a couple with a special needs child.
There is inevitably, there's always a strain on the marriage, but we are very blessed in the ability and that we've always had the ability to communicate well to one another. And before we ever got married, our values aligned as far as how we wanted to raise children and things like that. So I'm not going to pretend like everything's always honky-dory, but under the circumstances, we do fantastic.
So why? How do you guys do that? Because that is a big issue. And again, my observation has been among the families that don't stay together, it doesn't mean that both parents don't stay involved. There are some fantastic, many fantastic dads out there who are active financially, emotionally, with their time, but the relationship didn't work. Like, what do you guys do to keep the relationship strong?
So you just like you were saying earlier, you're able to communicate, but you don't understand. I don't understand what other parents are going through. So it's very hard for me to try to communicate how we're different or even how we're similar. Chris and I built a strong relationship from the beginning. We always talk about everything. We allow each other free time to take care of ourselves. There's just so many different elements that go into it, and it's a constant work in progress. And so, you know, there's going to be ebbs and flows, and just like there's ebbs and flows with Bryce, you know, some days he has really great days. Today was a really great, his mom's birthday is tomorrow, and somehow he knows it. I mean, I know we say things, but very often we don't know how much he's really taking in, but he woke up singing happy birthday in his own nonverbal way this morning to his mom, which is so cool. And he had such a good day, but then, you know, the next day there's no rhyme or reason. It's just meltdowns all day and fighting. And really we just end up trying to protect him from himself and protecting ourselves from him. And, you know, I don't know exactly how we do it. I know we tend to be positive people, as exhibited in my first book, you know. Faith is a big thing for us, and it wasn't always, but several things, including this, brought faith into the picture. And so we believe that Bryce relies on us and he needs us to be together and be successful in our marriage to get the best for him. And so I think that's a big part of it.
Are you going to continue to raise him at home, or have you thought about those options?
There was a time when he was younger, and this is hard to talk about because no parent wants to admit that they might not be able to do it. But we did have a hard conversation about that one night, and it's probably a conversation that I'll never forget. And, you know, just like I was talking about earlier about, you know, empathy and things like that, there's a lot of people out there who will never understand having to have a conversation with your spouse and saying, I don't know if we can do this. I don't know if we can raise him. But as you said, you know, we just exercise patience and try to take each day as a new day. Just like I talk about how, you know, every shot needs to be its own shot when you're out on the course, you know. Every day's a new day and we're going to get through it. It's possible that he'll live with us forever. It's possible that he'll be a very successful genius, you know, because people with autism, though they may have interact different socially, they also learn different and very often are very intelligent people, very intelligent. So we're excited to see that part of his life and see what his interests are and you know, how far that goes.
So one of the interesting things that happened when I was traveling was that I spoke to, well, at least, a, not at least, it was several parents, single moms each time, who were facing a decision about their child. And one I remember distinctly was a woman in Salt Lake City who had he was probably 7 or 8 years old, nonverbal, low functioning, but she came out to the event and she told me that this is, that she was, I don't know if she was having that conversation with a partner. I think it was having a conversation with herself about how to proceed. And then she asks my opinion. And I told her, you're asking the wrong person. Like I'm not qualified to answer these types of questions. And she says, but you know, I just want to know what you think, please help. And so it's that weird position where someone's asking you to give honest feedback, but you're not qualified and you know, what do you do? So I said, I remember saying, well, I'll give you my honest answer. I go, but you may or may not like it, but if you're asking me, I'm going to be honest with you. And she said, yeah. And I said, or I'm sorry. She first said that people were trying to talk her into doing this and she didn't want to do it. And again, I felt like, I don't want to answer this question, like, but you're standing in front of me. What do you do? And I said to her, I said, when you make your decision, don't just think about your child. I said, make the decision for both of you because both of you are part of this. Because Blue Power wasn't about the child with autism. It was about the child with autism and their siblings and their parents and their family. It's about everybody. It's not just about one individual. And most moms don't think of it that way. They think about child only. And I said, if you want my opinion, I said, you need to make the decision, not just what's best for the child, but also what's best for you as well. And yeah. And it was, and she cried. And that's why it's because she cried, because someone was just telling her it was okay, that whatever decision she made was okay.
Sure.
There wasn't a right or a wrong decision. It was, you know.
She needed somebody to crawl in that hole with her, and she probably couldn't find it anywhere. And so going back to something you were saying earlier, is I had the immediate thought that, you know, we all have special skill sets, and you have special skill sets and I have special skill sets, but those, we can use those to impact people in positive ways. And so, you know, you do the Blue Power and you do a lot of other things that help impact people in positive ways. And like I told you before, I'm not a professional disc golfer, but I'm a creative personality and I write things, and I just happened to write a book that seems to have helped a lot of people. I had a very, just a side note. Yeah. I had a very similar situation happen to me the other day. I was on the course and I was recognized, and they came over to me and they said, "You're Pat McCormick, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And, which it happens from time to time. "You're Pat McCormick." "Yeah. Can you show me how to throw a sidearm?" And I said, wait a minute. So.
Gotcha. It is. It's an interesting world we live in. All right. So, that's great. He sounds like a really lucky kid with two great parents. And I hope the two of you never forget that your relationship is critical to his success. His success is dependent on the two of you succeeding. And if you don't ever put you guys first, that's not in his best interest. And there, I'm going to get off my soapbox, but.
No, you're 100% right. And that's difficult because kids, all kids are demanding. And this is true for not just special needs children. That's true for all parents. We all need, don't put yourself so much first that it becomes a problem for the child. But, you know, very often marriages do have hard times because too much attention is paid to the child and not to each other.
Yeah. And when you talked about, I mean, I was so happy to hear that you even were doing date nights.
Trying to. So it's very difficult. We might have one every 4 months.
There's parents that feel like things like that are selfish in that situation. And I just, again, I'm not trying to be preachy, but they couldn't be more wrong. If you don't protect you guys, like, you guys are the foundation of his entire universe. And so, yeah. So again, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but you know, I keep focusing on the two of you. I think that's the most important thing you guys got going for him. Mm-hmm. All right. So now this is where we connected, which is a beautiful thing. The connections I'm able to make this way. So now you started thinking about writing another book. Well, not thinking about, your book came out a few weeks ago.
It's done. Yep.
Yeah. So tell me about it.
So let's see. The first book in 2014 was Zen and the Art of Disc Golf. That was the bestseller. About 2 years later, I coupled it up with another set of writings that were basically blog posts while I was doing the podcast. That was called Discs and Zen. It was about the same length. And then about 2 years later, I combined those into the complete Zen and the Art of Disc Golf. So there were already three books. One was just a compilation book. People used to ask, when's the next one coming out? And I just laugh. How do you write that many books about disc golf? But a couple months ago, I was sitting there and I was probably watching Jomez or something like that. And a thought hit me. Maybe I could do a third book. And part of the reason was I've been teaching, not like the amount of coaching that you do, but I bring a significant amount of people into the sport. And a buddy of mine, I was teaching him, and one day we were in the fire station because we worked together, and he said, "Remind me what the four numbers are on the disc." I said, "All right, well, let me go get, you know, dry erase marker and we'll go over some of this." About an hour later, I had filled this entire board up with all the stuff that he probably didn't want to know about, you know, flight ratings and stability and the science of different plastics and how molds are made and what wind does to different flight characteristics and the personalities of the disc, and on and on and on. And a guy comes up, also works for me, and he goes, "Oh, is that what your first book was about?" And I said, "No, it was about the mental side of the game." And he said, "Would you ever think about writing some of that down?" "Yeah, maybe, you know." And so I was also at the same time competing with a buddy of mine who's been whipping my tail for the past, I'd say, 3 years. I hadn't won a single round against him. And so I joked with him, and I'm going to throw his name out there, Tommy Brosom, because I was going to name the book Beating Tommy Brosom. So, do what now?
I said, that's a good name.
Yeah. I like it. Not really searched for on Amazon too much. But I got to thinking, you know, where am I faltering in my practice, in my training? What's going on? Now, I should say that, and if you want to go back to this, that's fine. I did have a significant injury, an accident a couple years ago that really impacted my ability to play. So I kind of had to start all over in about, I think it was 2017. I had to start learning again how to even throw and play. But anyway, so I was thinking about all of those things. And then I said, you know what? What if I compile those two things together? And so I wrote a book called Disc Golf Strategies and Tactics, a Zen Disc Golf Field Manual, kind of a play on Army field manuals. Mm-hmm. And the first, it's divided into two sections. The first section is tactics, and that is the smaller components that make up the game. And basically, I talk a lot about discs, how they're made, what flight ratings mean, the different personalities, reasons for different plastics, different stabilities, why I throw different weights, what you might want to throw in a headwind, which you might want to throw in a tailwind. Went over the different throws. Now that was the hardest part of the book to go over because I'm not Scott Stokely, so I can't teach people how to throw in a video, much less in words. So I did place in my book, go find a coach. So if we would have had this conversation before, I would have, you know, linked you up, but I said, that was like the first part of throws, go find a coach, but here's some other resources that can help you as well. So that was all the tactical side. That's the smaller parts of that make up your game. Now, a lot of that is kind of based on the newer player. So a lot of that's going to be, you know, the science of spin, how we got turn and fade and how that mirrors when we switch the direction of the spin from a backhand to a forehand or from, you know, right hand to left hand things. So the second part was strategies. And in strategies, I broke down a lot of different things that I had come up with that I've heard from other people just after a lot of research and thinking about what the best way to be strategic is in different. So I call it micro and macro strategy. So macro, the bigger part of strategy, obviously the macro strategy of playing disc golf is to get your disc to the basket in the lowest amount of strokes, right? Have right. The lowest amount of strokes at the end of the day. But micro strategy is what you're doing every time you step up to your disc. And so it's all about looking at different lines and all of the things that need to go through your head. How am I playing today? How does my body feel? Where's my mental game right now? And all of those things are going to affect how you play and strategize that day. And so I listed a lot of those things. I think that the book really shines in giving ideas for different types of practice rounds. It shines in different types of competitive rounds to going out and playing and having a good time with your buddies, just different challenges that you can do. It's just as much information as I could possibly put into a book. I just tried to think about all of the things. I mean, I even included some fitness stuff, you know, some kinds of workouts that can help you out on the course and things like that. So I tried to make it as comprehensive as possible, but tried to make it very easy to understand. And whereas I think that the newer player will gain a significant amount from the first part of the book, maybe a more intermediate player from the second part of the book. I learned this sort of about books a long time ago because I'm an avid reader. If you can pick up a book and you can go through 200, 300 pages, you're not going to remember every single thing that you read in that book. What you're going to remember are the things that are new to you and you can use, or are things that you're already doing and it kind of backs that up and says, hey, yeah, this is the right way to go. And those are the two things that people really look for when they're reading specifically a book that's meant to help them. Just a few takeaways, not 27 takeaways, because you can't remember all that. It's going to be three or four takeaways from, you know, 250 pages. And so while I think not all of the information is new to everyone, especially not to Scott Stokely, I think that there are golden eggs in every chapter, something that somebody's never heard before, and there's something to gain. So I'm pretty proud of how it turned out.
So I actually just recorded a video today on the mental game. Well, a very specific piece of the mental game. And what I mentioned in there is something that I call designer psychology.
Okay.
which is what it's exactly what you're talking about, which is you pick what works for you and throw away what doesn't.
True. Yes.
When it comes to the physical part of the game, you don't do that.
Right. Work on it.
There's physics, there's correct mechanics, there's a right and wrong way to throw, but the mental game will never be that way because we vary so much. You can't buy a book and go, that all works for me if it's above the neck.
You're right. Yep.
So I think that's kind of what you're saying, right? Is that there's things in every chapter you can find.
Yes. And I know there's things, and I even admitted in the book that some of these things, you know, people can argue, that's not how I do things. Okay, that's cool, because you'll find five other things that are valuable to you every one that you don't. And you know, hey, I have no problem admitting that I am not on the PDGA tour. I just play a lot and I enjoy writing. I'm a creative personality and that's what I do. And I've just found success in doing things this way. And while I do wish to compete some more, and like I was telling you earlier, really had a life-changing moment a couple years ago and I got in a significant accident having to learn to re-throw. I think I'm finally back at the ability where I can go out and start competing again or getting close.
Just let me help. This is what I do. I am making the bulk of my income by doing video private lessons. And I'm glad you didn't mention me in the book because I actually have about 350 people on a wait list right now.
Right. That's what you were telling me. That's great.
Yeah. I can't even. Yeah. My last number of videos that I've released, I don't even mention on there that I'm doing lessons. I'm like, the old residual lessons are coming in faster than I can handle. So, but I would squeeze you in. You get the friend rate. If you want to
be amazing.
If you want to beat your friend, we'll just team up on him. You'll beat him. I promise.
Let me tell you, he loves you because I introduced him to you. And there were some videos of you trash talking and he, that's what he does. Yeah. That's his bread and butter, trash talking. I will say December 24th, I beat Tommy Brosom. I told him I was going to change the end of the book. and he said, well, that's not fair. There's 38 mile an hour winds on Christmas Eve. I was playing in the same winds, brother.
Yeah. I was going to say, because what if he was a fan of mine, I could do a private lesson with him and then just give him bad advice.
Let's do that. Let's just say, hey, Scott Stokely said he would train both of us.
I'll screw him up for, I have a price. We'll talk off the air. But yeah, I can be bought.
I'm sorry?
I can be bought.
Nice. Nice, nice. You know,
I need a new fender for my Jeep. We had a blowout that blew off the fender and it blew out the electrical system in the front of the Jeep.
Oh, geez.
I know, right? It was so cool. I mean, it's a Jeep. So it's a 2005 Wrangler. It's TJ. It's like it's meant to look like it's been through hell and it has. So it's really
nice.
Cool.
Nice. I used to have an 03 Wrangler.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. I will never not own a Jeep again. It's the coolest. Well, you've seen the pictures. We've done all this backcountry camping and we just drive off into the desert or into the mountains somewhere and we get places other people can't go. It's the coolest thing.
That's the life. That's the life. See, I argued the same thing about a Prius back in 2014 and 2016 that I spelled freedom, P-R-I-U-S, because the gas prices were so high and I was getting like 50 miles to the gallon.
Right.
And I was the first to joke on myself for driving a Prius. So, but hey, I actually sold it. I don't drive it anymore. So thank God those were rough years.
to an investor in California, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Right.
That thing had 300 some odd thousand miles on it though. So that
it's was still right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, this thing's going to die sometime soon. I got to let it go. But you know, I still have something pretty fuel efficient because I do like to go about once a week and travel. I'll leave really early in the morning and I use a U-disc and I've got all of these courses that I have, you know, pinned saying that these are ones I want to play. And I'll drive up to 5 hours, play two or three courses and then come back that day.
Really?
About once every other week. So I'm not on tour like you, but that's how I get to experience my own mini disc golf tour.
Does your wife play?
She does not. She played one time and it was not a good experience for her. And it's kind of a funny story. I hope I don't embarrass her too much, but she thought the point of the game was to make aces on all the holes. This was before she really understood just trying to get as few strokes as possible in pars and things. She didn't grow up around golf. So she was very upset when she'd pull up to the tee pad and not even get close to the basket. She didn't understand how am I supposed to get it in the basket from 300 feet?
So here's the thing. If she would wanted to, when, if I got the chance to work with you online, if she gave me 30 minutes of her time, she might find that she likes the game. And I'll tell you why. When you're brand new, if you just are going to stand there, do this with your arm, and that this kind of flies one direction or another, there is absolutely no fun in that whatsoever.
Right.
And I am, I'm very good at teaching people how to throw correctly, to where within about 20 or 22 minutes, she's going to do a three-step run-up. She's going to pull the disc straight across her body. It's going to fly the direction that she's aiming, and it's going to fly about three times as far as she threw her first day. And what happens is, there's no guarantees, but what often happens, because I've worked with a lot of girlfriends and wives, what happens is they go, oh, now it's fun. Right. Because you're aiming and you're trying to shape the flight of the disc, and now you're looking at windows, and now you have objectives. You're not just randomly making the disc leave your hand. So if she was willing to give us 20 minutes, 25 minutes, I think there's a 60% chance you might go, okay, I'll play once in a while.
Nice. We might have to take you up on that. I do have a question though for you.
Yeah.
That goes back to earlier conversation. Sure. Nothing would make my heart happier than to get Bryce out playing disc golf. Now he's 5 years old, and his compliance level is pretty low, and he's nonverbal, so it's not that easy of a thing. But how do you change how you teach and how you coach for the special needs population?
Sure, absolutely.
Give me an idea as a dad how I can make him into the next Paul McBeth.
Happy to.
Or Scott Stokely. Sorry.
Well, he's going to need to go on a big old growth spurt and get really tall in about the next 4 years. So the only thing I teach as far as the physical part of throwing, and this is all dependent on levels. So you'll have to, you know, this, the old expression you've already heard, which is, if you know one kid with autism.
I've never heard that, but I could finish the punchline.
Yeah, because it's so individual. In fact, one of the things that you've probably heard, you're going to hear a lot of, they're going to go, oh, well, that's interesting. People with autism fill in the blank. And it's like, no, you can't generalize. It's impossible.
Right.
So what I'm sharing with you will be applicable possibly and possibly not. But the only thing I teach as far as the physical part of the game to anybody is what I call the scarecrow technique. And all the scarecrow technique is, you take the disc in your hand, you can put the disc in the hand close enough to how it's going to be held to throw, which is basically like this, just not upside down. And you then stand like a scarecrow. And if you stand like a scarecrow, whichever hand is holding the disc, that's where the disc is going to fly. That's the direction.
Right.
And the whole idea of the scarecrow technique is the disc will advance towards the target because you can make it go the right direction. You're not going in reverse.
Okay.
And it just allows a very simple way of aiming. It's the same thing I would teach you, which is you're going to square up 90 degrees from the target. But instead, we just talked about the scarecrow. That's the only technique that I use. When I'm trying to teach how to play, I call it adaptive disc golf, because at the Blue Power events, I don't have a game plan ever. Mm-hmm. Because people show up, and those people are going to be who knows what age, what level, who knows what parents are showing up. I mean, there's no way to predict.
Right.
So I would adapt it on the situation, but I would teach the scarecrow technique. And then what I would teach is what the game of golf is. I would stand 40 feet away. I would stand like a scarecrow. I would throw the disc 20 feet towards the basket. I would walk up, pick up the disc, stand like the scarecrow. I would purposely rotate the wrong direction. And, you know, if they're verbal, the people I'm working with, I'd say, is the scarecrow pointing the right way? They'd say, no. And then I'd say, tell me when. And I would turn and they'd go, now. And now I'm pointing the right direction. I would throw 20 more feet. And then I would go up to, then I'm a couple feet from the target. I'd pick up the disc again. I would stand like a scarecrow and I would put it in. That's golf.
Right.
That is 100% what the game of golf is. Advance the object to an end goal. And you measure your completion by the disc going in the basket, the ball going in the hole, right? So this isn't a different game. This is the exact same game you and I play.
Sure.
And what I found is the majority of people I worked with understood that. They understood the idea of advancing towards a goal and completion of the goal. And one of the really unique things, this was very strange. And when I've shared this with people within autism organizations, they were blown away by this. But this is God's honest truth. As you are maybe aware with Bryce or maybe not, but with him, but there's sensory issues. Loud noises are often disruptive or even painful to someone with autism. They can be. Mm-hmm. And what's very interesting is that when I would demonstrate this, the sound of the chains in 280 total events, I have yet to come across a player that was scared or put off by the sound of chains. Not one single time. And I think the reason why, even though it's loud, is that I think there's a connection made between that sound is a good thing.
Sure. Yeah.
And as soon as that connection's made, that it all of a sudden chains become a reward. It's mm-hmm. not a loud noise. It's not scary. It's just cha-ching, high five.
And to be honest with you, and I want to talk about that just real quick in just a second, because I think that's important for our listeners, something that they can, another takeaway they can take from this podcast. But the chains for us do the exact same thing. They drive dopamine in our brain, you know, the reward chemical. So when we hear those chains, we know that's a good thing. And that's why this is so addictive. You know, of course, and it's the same thing for regular, you know, ball golfers. When you hear the little ball go in the cup, it's the same thing. You know, it's a good sound and it releases that little bit of dopamine in the brain. I think that's a pretty interesting concept that you've kind of learned, that the little bit of dopamine drive that they get from that overcomes the sensory processing disorder.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
I mean, I'm not exaggerating. I have yet to come across, by the way, as soon as you say this, the very next time we do this, we'll come across it because that's the way autism works. But it hasn't been that has not been my experience.
Yeah.
A couple things to just add to this. One is, and this depends on level, obviously, of what level of functionality, but I'm a big fan of keeping score.
Me too.
Because part of what is fun about the game of golf is about quantifying your success with a number.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And then having a number to beat, a number to shoot for. And I think a lot of people, what I always say is, if you're not keeping score, you're not playing golf. You're just putting.
Right.
As soon as you keep score, and I've so many players, they wouldn't keep score themselves even. They would putt and they'd say, how many was that? And I would say, that's five. And then they were happy. And then it's like, we quantified it. And I think that a lot of the, you know, I mean, in your neurotypical, whatever word is you use today, your normal average American school, there's 8-year-olds that aren't keeping score at sports at school.
Right.
And I couldn't disagree with that philosophy more, but I think a lot of people would say, yeah, but if you have autism, you shouldn't keep score. Says who? Like, so who says you can't keep score? Who says you can't say, good job, you can do better? What, like, where does that become a bad thing?
So I don't know every autistic person in the world, obviously. I know one very special one.
Right.
But I know that people don't like being treated differently. So when you say, a certain person likes is it's okay to keep score with a certain person, but not with a certain person, you're automatically saying that they're disabled and they can't understand, or that it hurts them to do it. And that's, they don't want that. I think I can speak for the majority of, you know, special needs population to say that they don't want to be treated as if they're different. They just want to be human beings like the rest of us, as they are.
And how about a parent who keeps score for a child who isn't able to even connect the dots on what score means? Why doesn't the parent get to enjoy seeing the child improve?
Sure.
Well, yep. The whole thing about golf is, what is improvement? Well, it's written down on a piece of paper. It's not subjective. That is the sport we play. It's not a game. It's a sport.
Yeah.
So that is those are probably the biggest things I found, is that the scarecrow technique, teaching the game of golf can be understood. I'll say one final thing is that, and you're already aware of this, but the disc golf community and the Frisbee community in general is the best group of people I've ever known in my entire life. And if you didn't write the first or the most successful book in the history of disc golf, if you were just a parent with a child with autism, I would tell you, go out to your disc golf league, introduce yourself, tell them you want to join the league, tell them this is Bryce, he has autism, and you're going to get a warm reception. He's going to probably go home with 3 or 4 discs. And when you come out, people will remember him and high five him.
Yep.
You're a welcome part of the disc golf community. There's not a, I will speak for every disc golf club in the world and say, you autism special needs parent is welcome in our club. There's not a disc golf club in the world you're not welcome in, and will be embraced. And so that becomes one thing that, as again, as you know, that having a safe place for a parent who has a special needs child, you know, isolation is such a big issue. And when you go to Denny's, again, I'm preaching to the choir, I'm speaking to you, but I'm speaking to the people listening. When you go to Denny's and you have a situation that is potentially volatile and always unpredictable,
oh yeah,
there can be this real tendency towards, you know what, let's just not go to Denny's tonight, let's stay home. That is very, very common. And let's go over to a friend's house because they know about Bryce and they understand him. So if he has a meltdown, we're not going to be embarrassed or we're not going to be uncomfortable because they know about Bryce. Well, guess what? You introduce Bryce to and your family to a disc golf club. They understand Bryce. And then when Bryce has a meltdown, you're fine. Yeah. This isn't any, you're not getting dirty looks. You're getting empathy, and you're going to get people who say, I can't wait to see you next week, Bryce.
Yeah. And what you just described was probably our first 2 years of after we got diagnosed. Mm-hmm. There is an isolation, and it's even worse than that because you don't go to the friend's house because you know they tell you they understand, but you still don't feel comfortable enough to put that on other people. You know what I mean? Because it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable.
All right. Okay. So I'm going to, you're going to get mad at me here, but I'm going to call BS on you right here.
Go ahead.
If they're your friends and they say that you're welcome, it's not your responsibility to protect them. If they're your friends and they say they're welcome, and if they're uncomfortable, more power to them for telling you that you're welcome when they're uncomfortable. They're grownups. They can handle themselves. If they say that you're welcome, go. Don't try to protect them. You've been invited to people that want you.
And so you know, well, thank you. I appreciate the BS, but you're right. But the mindset is hard to get out of. I mean, especially when it's relatively new.
No, for sure.
For parents. But you are not wrong.
No, I'm taking both sides. I'm saying I have empathy for you, but I'm also kicking you in the ass and saying, if your friends say it, then that's their responsibility. And if they have a difficult night because of Bryce and they invited you over, they're grownups. They can handle it. You could handle it if you invited your friends over. If Bryce was a child in another household, you could handle it. Why can't they?
Yep.
They're your friends. They want you. Go.
And see, that's why you're a good coach. because you're empathetic, but you also kick your players in the butt. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I know. I and again, I always feel like I'm speaking out of turn, even giving advice, but I speak my mind and I'm honest, even if I'm wrong. I'll speak my mind.
There's usually nothing wrong with that. In fact, but you're definitely not offending me. It's still a pleasure and an honor to, you know, be on the show with you and get you on my show as well. I did want to talk about the sensory processing disorder really fast, because I think that's something that people don't understand a lot. So you mentioned earlier that loud noises bother some special needs children. And it also goes into all of the other senses. So there's taste, touch, feel, hearing, and things like that. So some, not all people with sensory processing disorder are autistic, but a lot of autistic people have sensory processing disorder. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%.
So there's two different like directions, and I'm not going to act like I'm a doctor or specialist in this. I'm only giving you what is experiential for me. There's sensory seeking and there's sensory trying to move away from. So like, for example, sensory seeking is a lot of calming type things that sensory processing disorder people have. They'll have soft fabrics or stuffed animal, something that keeps them calm. So there's that thing. Also sensory seeking could be in the, we call it flapping. So when they get really excited, it's almost, they say it's almost like they got like an electric energy within them that's just flying off when they begin to flap, when they get excited. And there's different forms of that. It's called stimming. So if you see, I don't even know what direction I want to go with this, but just having people have an understanding of the sensory processing disorder, I think goes a long way. A lot of times when Bryce, let's say we do go to Denny's, we're not a Denny's family, but let's say we did go to Denny's, sometimes things will bother him and we'll have zero understanding of what he's perceiving in his senses that are overpowering his ability to control his emotions. It could be lights. It could be sounds. It could be a frequency. It could be something that we can't even hear, like a frequency that's going on, like buzzing in lights, things like that. And so I just thought it would be, because you brought it up, it's really important for people to understand this sensory processing disorder as well.
Well, and that's the thing about the disc golf community is that you've got, you average Joe parent, you're going to make friends. You're going to be having conversations on the golf course. They're going to get to know your child. They're going to get to know you. They're going to hear about your story, just the way you'll know about their work, and you'll hear about their recent divorce. I mean, you're going to know them too. I mean, it's what we do when we golf. We talk for 2.5 hours. And so it's a chance to make a group of people familiar with your situation that you don't have to feel. I can't say I don't have to. That sounds like I'm discrediting the anxiety, but it's an opportunity to have a less anxious environment because you're welcome and it's a club. That's what disc golf is. Disc golf clubs are clubs. The number one goal of every disc golf club in America or in the world is more members. That's it. You're welcome.
Fantastic. And that I think is a big part of the therapy that disc golf offers. It's not just playing the game, but it's the it's the socialization that goes along with it too.
It is. I love it. So yeah. So keep me updated on the progress. It should be fun. Like I said, very few people I've ever worked with didn't get the concept of golf, although most of them were older. So five is young, but sure. The concept of golf, advance, progress, success is a sport concept that translates. It just does. And it translates visually. You can watch it and do it. So I'm a big believer disc golf is the best game in the world for kids and adults with special needs. I say special